Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Economics Design Podcast. Today, I'm joined by Lars Doucet, former game developer and author of Land is a Big Deal, Why Rent is High, Wages Too Low, and What We Can Do About It. Lars has some interesting articles published on gamedeveloper.com and was also a writer for the Navik team. Lars, thanks for joining me on the podcast today.
Great to be here.
Do you want to start off by telling us a little bit about yourself?
Yeah, so I mean, how deep you want to go? I guess I'll give the short version. So I'm actually still technically a game developer. I have a game coming out soon, hopefully, called Defender's Quest 2. It's been in development for way too long, but I've been nursing it along for a long time, and I'm still, although my day job now is in actually real estate valuation, I still am leading a team that is over at Level Up Labs that is finishing up DQ2. But after that, DQ2 will probably be my swan song, my last game. Prior to that, I was so I've had a career in game development for over 10 years. I had Defender's Quest 1, which was a quite successful indie game back in the day. Afterwards, I became a consultant. I consulted for a lot of people in and around the industry, big games, little games, all sorts of things. And then the past year before I created this new startup, I was working for Navik, and that was during the height of the crypto game bubble. And so I did a lot of analysis of all of the hot crypto games for Navik, which is kind of where I made a name for myself, along with my colleague Anthony Pecorella and a bunch of my other friends at Navik. Big shout out to my colleague over there, Jimmy Stone, and Manu and the rest of the team. They're really great people. And so I've kind of done a little bit of everything, you know, both game design and programming, but also economic consulting. And I've written a lot of articles about virtual real estate, which is probably why you had me on this pod. But I kind of come at it from every angle, from either working on games directly or analyzing them from a high level. And I've, you know, written a good deal about economics as it pertains to video games. So that's kind of my whole oeuvre of things that I've done lately.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. Yeah, I'm excited to get into the topic of virtual land sales. That will definitely be a large focus of today's conversation, as well as the land value tax, which is discussed quite frequently in your book and as well as a couple other podcast episodes that you've participated in. So to start off with the first question, Lars, could you tell us what have been the most significant mistakes in your opinion regarding land sales and land designs in the blockchain gaming space so far?
Well, you have to understand that the problems with land sales and virtual real estate as a category predates blockchain games. That's the most important thing to realize is actually, and that's a general category of general mistake with blockchain games, is that a lot of people coming into the blockchain gaming space did not have a background in games and immediately started to make a bunch of mistakes that seasoned game veterans would not have made. And they spent a good, you know, couple of years learning those lessons, sometimes quite brutally, that if they had, you know, looked to the 30, 40 year history of games that had come before, they would have learned some of these things. So the basic mistake of virtual real estate is not understanding the nature of land economics. And it's quite a fundamental mistake, in my opinion, because there's been an ongoing virtual housing crisis in non-blockchain games for decades. There's still one going on in Ultima Online, to the best of my knowledge. There's one that, as far as I can tell, still hasn't been fixed in Final Fantasy XIV. But we've seen it in plenty of other games, like Star Wars Galaxies had some aspects of land speculation, even though they didn't even have a formal land market. It still manifested in other ways. And it's cropped up in plenty of games. And what land speculation essentially is when there's a scarce resource category that I call a land-like asset, which usually but not always bears the theme of land. What happens is that you have a first mover advantage to people who get in the game early. They do a somewhat literal land grab. Mm-hmm. And they grab up all these assets that are scarce, necessary for production, and that obtain value from their location. And then basically those people become gatekeepers to the economy essentially forever. And then you've got yourself locked into this really tight box where your early adopters essentially become landed gentry. And they basically expect the other players to serve them through rent-seeking behavior. They expect to essentially collect rent perpetually from future players, and future players are not interested in paying rent either literally or in other ways that can manifest. And so then your game kind of stagnates and dies. And people basically get this vibe. It's like, oh, I didn't start playing the game early enough, so therefore I can't have any fun in it because the core features of the game are gatekept. And how much this kind of virtual speculation damages your game depends entirely on how important the land-like assets are to actually playing the game. So Ultima Online has been a successful online game for decades because that and it is able to sustain this unfixed problem of a speculative housing market because housing is a sideshow to the game. But the real mistake that the blockchain games made, besides, you know, my broader critique of blockchain games in general, is that they made the speculative aspect of land ownership very, very central, almost the entire point of many of these games. And so therefore, this problem that has been a thorn in the side of these other games is more like a stake right through the heart, essentially. You know, just kind of defeating the game before they even got off the ground. And I made these very bold predictions at the height of the bubble when a lot of these games were coasting on, were just bragging about how expensive their land sales were. And I feel pretty vindicated in the results of where everything stands now. So that is how I would characterize what the biggest core mistake is.
Mm-hmm. That's interesting. And one of the things that came to mind when talking about these, you know, massive land sales in the last 5 years or so, is the question of whether this is going to be a continued trend into the next 5 to 10 years, or is this something that's kind of settling off now that we've seen this time and time again occur? So my question for you, Lars, is what do you predict in terms of land sales the next couple of years? If blockchain gaming takes off a little bit from the development of AAA games, do you think that these land sales are actually going to grow more mainstream and more the average player will be more likely to participate in them? Or is this something that's going to grow even more niche?
I think basically it's been proven really spectacular as a model that doesn't work. A lot of the people who are in the know increasingly openly admit that it doesn't work. A bunch of the people who had been its biggest boosters and bragged about high-priced land sales, a couple months later immediately started editing their white papers and crowing about sustainability and saying that this was never the plan all along, you know, just kind of like retroactively scrubbing their own history and propaganda about their own games. And so I think it's kind of destined to be a more niche thing. And I think land ownership is going to be considerably reimagined in these games. There'll still probably be things they call land, but any project that's actually going to be successful is going to implement it very differently from your classic land sale. Because I just think that brutal economic lessons can only be learned so many times. I mean, I think the only way we're ever going to see anything like the virtual land bubble of the early 2020s is if you just find an entirely new category of people, frankly, to fool that have not learned this lesson.
Mm-hmm. That's interesting. So let's talk about the use cases in which virtual land has been appropriate or arguably is appropriate. So, you know, Alluvium, for example, that's an example of gameplay where land isn't critical in order to play the game. So do you foresee this type of model being more likely to develop?
Well, we don't even have to make predictions. It's just exactly what's already happening. If you look at the white papers, it's almost like a fossil record of before and after the crashing of the great virtual real estate bubble. You can see everyone moving towards, you know, what I called either land dilution policies, where essentially Axie Infinity most famously did this, where basically they still called it land and they, you know, it's just, this manifested in two ways. First, with the people who already had an established class of landowners, and then people who didn't. So people who already had a class of established landowners, they basically pursued land dilution strategies, where they basically, as the gods of their game universe, changed the rules of what land meant. Mm-hmm. You know, either making, you know, it's like, oh, land is still going to be scarce. And so they focus everyone's attention that land would be scarce, but they made it less necessary. Or the benefits that accrued to land could be obtained in other ways, which of course completely undermines the speculative value of that asset. Yeah. But they had to back themselves out of that corner somehow while still technically maintaining at least one of their promises. So that's one strategy that everyone who had this entrenched landowner class, kind of a policy they pursued. The second category we saw was people who were launching new games. they really, really were interested in having that marketing potential of land sales, but they were trying to have their cake and eat it too. Mm. So they would do things like, okay, well, land is just kind of a nice to have thing. A lot of these attempts, in my opinion, were fairly half-hearted. But you could really tell there was a lot of cognitive dissonance there, because they were really trying to because they were still very much targeting the crypto gaming customers of that large bubble period and trying to basically make a kind of more nuanced sales pitch. And it wound up being like, okay, we don't have ice cream, but we have broccoli frozen yogurt. Don't you want to come get some? And, you know, the response was considerably more muted. But I think, you know, there was this reflection of reality. And so it all comes down to, you know, when I say a land-like asset, you know, let me be really clear about what that is. It is an asset that's scarce in supply, necessary for production, and that obtains value from its location. And sometimes it is possible to create a game that has none of these. Sometimes it's not. Sometimes they arise whether you try to create them or not by just the very nature of your game. And even if you don't have a fundamental market for them, they can still arise. Like in Star Wars Galaxies, they had this feature where you could build player-controlled cities. So there wasn't a land market, but those cities had to go places. And so if you put a city somewhere, your faction was kind of in control of that area. Well, people started putting these over the entrances to dungeons. Mm-hmm. And so they were essentially able to build a fence around a dungeon and charge a toll gate, which was not the intent of the developers, but it arose anyway, right? And so that's kind of what I mean by this. But the main issue with these blockchain games is that they very intentionally created these very rationalized markets for speculative assets with exactly these properties. And so I predict, I'm going to forget the original question here if I don't stop rambling. What I'm seeing is that people are basically continuing to keep the theme of land and just reducing those three properties to either weaken them or remove entire categories of them, but still calling it like land. You know, you'll have land that doesn't exist in any kind of a map, so that there's no locational benefit that you can accrue from your neighbor. Or there's land, but it's not technically scarce. Or there's land, but you don't necessarily need it to play the game. Or it obtains those three values, but only within a very narrow scope. That's kind of optional to the main thrust of what the game is actually about. So yeah. It's like, if you want to do the land stuff, you need land, but you don't need what the land does in order to experience the game itself. And mm-hmm. We don't really need to predict that that's where things are going. That's just literally where we've essentially already arrived. And I expect us to continue down that direction.
Okay. And so one of the things that you mentioned was the fact that there's policy, quote unquote, policy changes around the utility of land within blockchain games, and how, you know, game developers have changed that as the game has progressed. One of the thoughts that I had is, if you're having a situation where there's hundreds of millions of dollars of assets, virtual land, or even millions for that matter, and then all of a sudden the game developers are able to just go and change those rules, I wonder from a political perspective or around creating policy, how that might come to fruition. Because it's my opinion that if, for example, the amount of value, you know, went from the tens of millions or even hundreds of millions into the billions in some point in the future, you know, that might be a serious concern for politicians around the rules and regulations game developers are able to create around these virtual assets. You have any thoughts on that point?
Okay, so you're talking about like real world politics and not just, you know, within game communities?
That's correct.
Yeah, well, that gets into, you know, the Howey test and SEC regulations and all of that good stuff, right? You know, so the fundamental issue I kind of have with a lot of blockchain stuff in general is that it was essentially a kind of phenomenon of the world of zero interest rates. And what was really trying to be attempted with a lot of these projects was essentially a way to create what was essentially a share, a dividend-bearing share that you could essentially give to, or that's at least how it was pitched, all these governance tokens, mm-hmm. rhymed a lot with basically dividend-bearing shares, but you didn't have to be an accredited investor to get them. And there was this big song and dance about, oh, progressive decentralization. It's not decentralized now, it's going to be decentralized later. Mm-hmm. And we saw this in all these white papers, and that was pitched. Like, there are many reasons that was pitched. One, for simplicity's sake. You know, we're going to iterate, and before we cast everything in stone, we're going to, you know, figure it out, and then we'll decentralize. But another reason that I think is quite credible is that this was a particular legal opinion at the time of how to get from point A to point B without ever triggering the Howey test, which is, you know, basically the test for whether something counts as a security that needs to be regulated. And that was typically done with governance tokens. And so Land was kind of a super governance token, right? It was not just like this little token that's going to let you vote on things and then it's going to obtain value because people want to like be able to trade the ability to vote. But it's going to be this thing that essentially allows you to extract value out of the economy. Mm-hmm. Now, Land, because it's this feature in the game itself that allows you to basically extract the value provided by your neighbor and gatekeeps access to the entire economy, yeah. sets up this entire category of rentiers, is strictly speaking inferior to just a share in the company. Like, it would be way better if I could have a share of Cliche Quest 12, the ultimate MMO, you know, than a plot of land there that lets me gatekeep the economy. Because if I'm a passive investor who doesn't actually want to play the game or do anything, it's way better that I just like, okay, if the game makes money, I make money. We're aligned. You know, here's some capital invested in the game. Yeah. As opposed to I'm going to extract value out of all these players and hold an asset that's necessary for producing UGC out of use. So that's basically my take on the whole deal.
Oh, interesting. All right. So let's get into virtual economies. So my question for you was, what have we learned from existing virtual worlds such as EVE Online that can be applied to current blockchain games and the so-called metaverse?
Right. So EVE Online is really interesting because there's two versions of it, essentially. There's the version at launch and there's the version that we have right now. So EVE, I've never played EVE, but I've interviewed people who've played it, and so I'm vaguely familiar with it. I'm not going to go into too much detail. But one of the features of EVE when it started, which is very different from the game now because it's a freaking old game, is when EVE first started, it had a recession. And it's been very famously covered. There's this famous blog post by an economist, Raman Chakrazadeh, who kind of chronicles it. And he kind of uses it to like brag that it allowed him to predict the 2008 housing crisis, just like whether you buy that or not, who knows. But what he chronicles is that in the early days of EVE, there were these nodes at particular locations. They were called factories, but they functioned as if they were land because they were only be created by the government of EVE, which was the developers, right? The gods of that world. There was a strict number of these nodes. And if you held the node, you had the right to produce spaceships. Mm-hmm. And if you didn't hold the node, you couldn't produce spaceships. You had to, you know, in some way gain access to the node, either, you know, which basically allowed people who were holding the nodes to basically extract rent out of anyone who actually wanted to put in-game currency into the production of spaceships. And so they wound up with a spaceship production recession. No one was producing cool spaceships. Everyone was sitting on these spaceship making nodes and just basically holding them out for a better price. And Raman Chakrazadeh comes in and says, okay, what you need to do is you need to apply a high holding cost to these nodes. So these unproductive speculators are going to hot potato off of it. And only someone who's deriving enough income from producing spaceships is going to want to hold the node. And that's going to more efficiently allocate your capital. And I responded to Raman at the time in this article, and I said, isn't this Henry George's land value tax? And he said, who's Henry George? What's a land value tax? And I said, it's Henry George is the guy who proposed the policy that you just came up with. And he had independently arrived at the same solution from first principles, which I thought was really fascinating. Now, modern EVE is in a very different place. There's no longer that particular design, you know, and they no longer have that spaceship recession. They're well past that phase. And so digital land in EVE now, you hear about these like famous turf wars and stuff. So EVE is divided into various security levels, like high security or where you can basically count on, you know, basically spaceship police to protect you versus NullSec, where it's just the Wild West. And that's where all the fun stuff happens, right? And so in EVE Online, turf allocation, like being able to control land, which is to say space in EVE, in NullSec territory, is essentially allocated by the laws of the jungle, the same way animals allocate territory. And the way animals allocate territory is they fight each other and they threaten each other. So animals know, it's like that guy, that lion on that hill is really scary. I know I'm not as strong as him. I'm not going to bother fighting him. or I think I have a chance at getting him. I'm gonna make a jump, or I'm gonna get my pack of like younger males, and we're gonna go fight him for it. And so the way law of the jungle allocation of land is kind of efficient in one sense, because there's no police, there's no title, there's no state that's gonna enforce your deed. It's just and basically the cost of defending territory has to be proportional to the income you're receiving from it. Like, you need to be able to spend less on defense than you are in income, but you're spending an increasing amount of defense relative to the demand for the location, which will be proportional to its value. So basically, if there's a really valuable part of the jungle, you better be a fierce freaking monster. And if you're not a fierce freaking monster, you find a less valuable part of the jungle to stay off. And everyone basically allocates a piece of territory that's relative to how much blood they're willing to spend. And so in my policy paper, I call that blood taxes. Another good example of this would be Reddit.com/r/place. This was a kind of mini game they made as an April Fool's joke, which is really fun. You just basically, it's this community building mural. It's just a giant grid of pixels. And every 5 minutes, you can place one pixel in one of like 8 or 10 colors. That's it. That's the only rule. And from this comes this very emergent like community building of pixels, right? And what you're paying with is your attention, right? You and a bunch of your friends are in a Discord channel being like, here's our graphic, let's make this. Because there'll be incursions from around you, like putting in random pixels to see if you will immediately revert them. Like, are you weak? Can we annex your territory? So this is another form of blood taxes. But in this case, it's like, are you willing to spend your entire weekend sitting in a Discord? You know, the problem with blood taxes, or, you know, Reddit's attention taxes, is that it's freaking stressful. This is why society invented title to land, so that you could basically hold land and know that the king would come and defend, the king or the sheriff would come and kick off a trespasser, so that you don't literally have to be a brutal warlord all the time, every day, right? And so basically I'm kind of transitioning from virtual games to real ones, but on the far opposite extreme is the English tradition of land ownership, which is called fee simple. You pay a fee, you own it, and you are guaranteed for life the monopoly of violence of the state to come and defend your claim forever. And all of the value of that land will accrue to you. And this has all the problems that I've discussed before. In Second Life, there was a lot of talk in Second Life about, you know, back in the day when it was big, about like Second Life land barons and virtual real estate. You know, people who were around in 2008 have had this conversation before. The difference in Second Life, I can't remember what it was like in 2008, but the difference with Second Life today is that land is not scarce. You can print more land. So it's similar to like in, you know, you can go around, you know, so if people just want to make more space, they just make more space. And so land is not nearly as speculative as it is in some of the blockchain games. But those are basically the general lessons. And then to touch on Ultima, because that was one of my clear examples. In Ultima, you had a server, and the server was this whole contiguous map of the world, and you could build a house. Houses were not like super expensive relative to the land, because the land, you could just plop down a house anywhere. So that was like fee simple land ownership, where the fee was zero. You would just hold the land by putting a property there. And the problem was, it filled up really fast. People would just put houses everywhere you could put something. And so like within the first cup, like, I mean, immediately all of the good land was taken. And so people would put just a crappy house down just to hold it, right? And you'd have to go on eBay to buy that crappy house from them, to buy the key to it, to essentially unlock the plot. And they would go for quite a lot of money. And it was proportional to how close those land plots were to the biggest cities. And because they had multiple shards, whichever was the most popular server. So if you wanted real estate close to the city of Britain, you could get it really, really cheap on a shard with no players. But that's the same as saying, it's like, yeah, you can get a mansion in the middle of the Nevada desert. Like, location, 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 that's what I care about, right? People would rather live in a shoebox in a big city than in a mansion in the Sahara Desert, you know, because they want to have those amenities and all those benefits that come from the agglomeration effects of things. And so what was really interesting, the lessons we learned, or all the traditional lessons of land economy and urban planning, in a way, it was really kind of eerie how many parallels there were. And you would have people like talking about reforms. It's like, well, what if we made like all the real estate bigger on the inside than the outside. So there's more space, or like subdivided it so you could place multiple houses on one location. And I'm like, now we're talking about YIMBY policies, about upzoning for density, you know, and all of these things, you know. And then people were like, well, they should, long-term players should have the right to build and no one else. It's like, now we're discriminating against immigrants and foreign owners and things like that. And having, anyway, it completely parallels all of the conversations of the housing crisis today, which was just utterly fascinating to me. Anyway, I've gone rambling on for a bit too long there.
No, I think that answered my question perfectly and highlighted some very important points about the land value tax and how it's been implemented in a variety of virtual worlds. I have a question for you, for game developers listening to this podcast. What should game developers know about the land value tax and implementing that tax, whether it's how much of a percent of a tax that is being implemented using this system? What general information should they know?
So the land value tax is the proposed solution to land speculation. Now, the first zeroth law of solving land speculation in video games is stop hitting yourself. Like, you don't need a solution if you don't have a problem. So try not to create a speculative land problem in the first place. Like, don't paint yourself into a corner where you now have to do economic management to get yourself out of it. So that's my first rule. Like, if you can avoid creating a land-like asset that's really core to your game's economy and going to attract speculators and gatekeepers, just don't do it. But the thing is, you can still wind up with this, and it's important to realize why. Because you can't necessarily fix it just with supply alone. For instance, the Earth has approximately infinite land in any sense that we actually care about. It's not really infinite, but it's like we are not running out of land in the Gobi Desert or the Nevada Desert or the Sahara Desert or any of the deserts.
Yeah.
There's like, we are nowhere close to filling up every square inch of Earth with humans, and we never will. Mm-hmm. But what we are running out of is space next to other humans. It is other humans that create the value of land. Yeah. It's not the dirt itself. It is those network effects, right? And so you see this in Ultima Online, where you might have 10 servers, but Atlantic is where everyone wants to be, and Britain is where the action is. So those locations within locations will always attract agglomeration effects. And agglomeration effects is where there's this valuable network of people close together. And the value of those social networks seeps into the connected graph that is the geography of your game, if that geography can be gatekept. And so with land value tax, how do you deal with this policy? So what land value tax does is capture the passive rental value of land, and specifically the unimproved value, the amount that you can extract in rent just by holding it. But it doesn't tax, crucially, it doesn't tax any value add on top of that. It doesn't tax any buildings or improvements. And a tax that does tax all the value of the improvements is a property tax. And this is the difference between a land value tax and a property tax. A land value tax is essentially a property tax with the value of all buildings and improvements completely exempted. And so, but a land value tax is not the only solution you need. You know, but I'll explain how it works. Basically, the idea is that you want to capture that rental value, because if you capture the rental value and basically make it so that you're charged, like essentially the government is charging that, so you're paying rent to the community rather than to basically a private government that is issuing a private taxation, what that effectively does is it drives the selling price of land to zero, right? Because if the holding cost of the land is high enough, no one is going to, you know, the land is essentially worthless as a speculative asset. But it is still valuable as a productive asset if you can multiply its productivity above its bare amount, the amount that you could basically get for just holding it, right? And so an example would be in a downtown area, like imagine if Times Square was being used for a parking lot. Or used for a use store it or some really low value usage. Mm-hmm. You charge that value to, and you will find empty lots like this downtown, especially in places like Houston, you know? And if you were to charge them the full rental value of that extremely low value usage, they would sell it immediately to someone who wants to build housing, a business, something useful, yeah. Right? And makes your economy way more vibrant. So how do you do this? Well, the easy way to do this is you don't even need to use a tax. A tax is a way to do, the tax is proposed in real life as basically a matter of practicality, right? But in the video game world, essentially the best way to do it is with short-term land leases. Because in video games, we have rules of physics we can make up that we don't have in the real world. Mm-hmm. First of all, a video game starts as a blank slate. You're the god of that universe. You already own everything. You created it. So you can lease every parcel of land out basically at market value. So now you don't have to like worry about calculating or price discovery. It's just, what will the market bear? And the specific mechanism I recommend is what's called a sealed vicary auction. What this is specifically is an auction where everyone's bid is private and the winning bid is the highest bid, but the price they pay is the second highest bid. And this essentially, bottom line, incentivizes that people bid what they think it's actually worth rather than trying to game it and actually trick themselves into paying more than they want, which is what you want when you're doing an income maximizing auction, like, you know, when you're at Sotheby's or whatever. But that's different because you want price discovery. So you do a vicary auction, short-term leases. So like every, I don't know what the period is, depends on your game. And then what's convenient is that in a video game, unlike in real life, you can perfectly separate the improvements. So in Final, this is what I recommend they do in Final Fantasy 14. Instead of having this like basic lottery system where you have to like wait and like camp on a placard and like wait for it to go live, you just make it so that it's like, okay, just everyone, just every month or every 2 months or whatever, every plot goes up for sale. And everyone basically bids sealed auction how much skill they want to pay. And then when the timer comes up, the winner here is the highest bid. They pay the second highest bid. If there's no second highest bid, they get it for free. And then, well, what happens to the houses? Well, in a video game, houses are digital. So you can just put it in your pocket. You can move it at zero cost, yeah. Right? And so that, so there's your population solved right there. If they did that, Final Fantasy XIV's housing problem would be solved. Only people who are interested in using the housing market for actually creating cool houses will use it. Everyone who's just using it to speculate will flee the market. And housing in Final Fantasy XIV would become way more fun overnight. If you want to do a land value tax, you can do it, and then you got to assess the value of the land separately from the buildings. This is still easier than it would be in real life because you could basically just take bids on the land versus bids on the housing. And you would use mass appraisal methods that are similar to the ones we use in real life. It's just more math, and it's more involved, and the auctions are easier. So that's how I would recommend it.
Okay. That was a ton of information, Lars. Thanks for unraveling that. I mean, topics covering, you know, a variety of topics. I'm sure our listeners are just like taking notes at the moment. And also, I'm sure that parking lots, I mean, not that parking lots can do any listening, but I'm sure the parking lots aren't feeling too happy right now based on those examples. But I want to move on to the subject of a metaverse. You know, there's been certain theories about how a metaverse might develop, whether that's through, you know, some type of virtual world, through its Facebook's investments for the last couple of years. What do you view as a potential way to create a metaverse? And do you think that the virtual worlds we've seen so far in the gaming space can unlock that potential?
Yeah. So when I talk about metaverses, I think it's really interesting because everyone has a really different definition of what is a metaverse. And I think it's just important to look at probably arguably the most successful metaverses out there. Often, like some of them are names are recognized, but others like are kind of just like kind of quietly succeeding in the background. And so metaverse broadly defined is this like kind of like third place, this like hyper-connected online world. Mm-hmm. I think what we're really seeing, like everyone imagined it, is this is like super persistent space of all these like different, basically like a 3D internet as envisioned in like Hackers combined with like Snow Crash. But what we actually got were more siloed metaverses, you know, more company town metaverses, where each company like has their metaverse full of hyper-connected people with tons and tons and tons of users and all this expressiveness and customizability and third placeness and stuff, but it's all within their gatekept world. And the most provably successful ones are, in no particular order, are Fortnite, Minecraft, Rec Room, VR Chat, and Second Life. And none of those currently have blockchain in them, but what they do have is a just shockingly high number of monthly active users, including Second Life. Like Second Life is, you know, far more modest than the other four I mentioned, but it's still up there. And a lot of people forget that Second Life is still alive and kicking. And Roblox, I'm not sure if I mentioned Roblox, but like Roblox is definitely Roblox is just absolutely huge. One of the things that all of these have in common is none of them have the whole classic virtual land. In Roblox, virtual land is infinite. You want to create a new world? Boof. Have more virtual world.
Yeah.
Like, and then the way they do discovery also is very different. You know, a lot of people imagine when they imagine a metaverse, they imagine something closer to what like Decentraland or The Sandbox built. This very like literally, what's the word? Like diegetic almost. I'm not quite sure what the exact word is, but this very literal, like embodied, hyper-connected space that you actually traverse. I call it a virtual mall, right? Where you have this big sprawling place and, you know, it's very similar to the premise of a mall. It's like, okay, you'll get like foot traffic and you'll have like this attraction and that attraction and people will come for this, but then they'll see that and then they'll go over there and teenagers will just come and hang out. And that's mostly not really played out that way. That's not been super successful because for the same reasons that malls themselves are in decline. When people want to buy shoes, what do? They go to Amazon and they like click, click, click. You know, if they want to buy like this or that, they go to Amazon, they go to a catalog view and they click. And that's exactly how you experience content in Roblox. You go to a catalog and you click, I want to go to this obby simulator X439.
Yeah.
Go with werewolves. And you just go. And so I think that's kind of, it's not really even, that's kind of my shtick again, is like, it's not even a prediction. It's just where we've actually arrived. It's like, I think people don't realize how much of the future is actually already here. Mm-hmm. In terms of like things like Horizon Worlds, I am skeptical based on what I've seen that is really going to take off. I think people underestimate how many barriers yet remain in VR and AR and whether people are going to like really want like a screen plastered over their face all day. But then, is this all that different? I'm not sure. You know, this is me looking at my smartphone, you know, with a screen plastered in front of my face. So who can say? I do think that if they were to make another order of magnitude jump in quality, maybe AR or VR could get us somewhere. I do think any metaverse that arrives will mostly be in buzzword name alone, and it will be greatly transformed from the classic Snow Crash vision of the metaverse.
Mm-hmm.
But who can say?
Okay, so, you know, we talked about Roblox there and Minecraft. Let's talk about NFTs a little bit and player-owned assets. One of the main selling points of blockchain games is the ability to, firstly, make something and then sell it for a profit, or one, buy something and then have the opportunity to sell that thing and reinvest your money into buying a different card or spending something, some amount of money in another game, for example. And that's also one of the advantages of a virtual world, actually, is the ability to do that. So, Lars, What do you think about NFTs and video games?
Yeah. Also, I mean, I've gone on the record as that I've been pretty negative about them. But I think this is another example of where blockchain advocates need to learn from video game history, because we have had all of those things before with earlier systems, including like a good example is, I can't remember the exact acronym, but there's this super old forum for Diablo 2 that expanded into this informal network of trading items between video games. I forget what it was called. Like for a while, like the big like fungible currency aspect was like Stone of Jasper or something in Diablo 2. What they would do is that they would, and it all ran on trust. It was the opposite of blockchain. Basically, what you would have is that they would have, you would meet one of their forum operators in your game of choice, and you would give them your items. And that trusted forum operator would give you forum gold on this dinky little forum. And then you would then trade that totally super fiat currency for an item in another game that a forum operator in that other game who recognized your account would come and give you. Yep. Now, it was never like super popular, but then to be frank, you know, the monthly active user counts of all these NFT games are low too. In terms of other things, though, like interoperability between games, I think anyone who is very sold on the possible future of interoperability of assets between games, especially anything where you can cash out for money, really needs to read this excellent series of articles by Raf Koster. Raf Koster was the lead designer of Ultima Online and Star Wars Galaxies and all these other classic games. He's currently running this company called Playable Worlds. They're making this product called Playable Worlds, which I think is whatever the actual metaverse will look like. It'll probably be that. He has this great series of articles called How Virtual Worlds Work. And he goes on this entire deep dive of, among other things, the interoperability problem. And if you're not a game developer, it's really hard to appreciate just how much it's not gonna ever happen that you can take your sniper rifle out of Halo and take it into Tekken or whatever. Just not even from the level of just dealing with the assets, which is itself a huge pain in the butt, but just in terms of just like fundamental balance and just how much these companies essentially have no incentive whatsoever to communicate on that. Economically, it's also like, but more fundamentally, there's an economic incentive problem, because if you incentivize people, they'll bend over enough to do anything for you. But the main issue is that it's like, basically someone at like Bored Ape Yacht Club, I'll take a great example. What incentive do I as a game developer have to create, to service members of the Bored Ape Yacht Club? They come to my game, they flash their NFT badge as if it's a passport. It's a passport to the metaverse, right? They paid a one-time upfront fee expecting a lifetime of benefits. And a lifetime of benefits provided among by Yuga Labs and also not Yuga Labs, that other people would want to attract BAYC club members to their venues, whether that's a game or a metaverse or whatever. But if I'm just some random developer, there's no mechanism for me to get a cut of that. That person's already paid for that lifetime membership to Yuga, not to me. Why am I going to go like model a bunch of 3D monkeys to make this guy happy who's going to have all these demands and expectations for me to entertain him, right? There's absolutely nothing in it for me. And until someone works out some system that makes sense, and I have my kind of skepticism with blockchain, but that's what it would take. You would have to create some revenue system that sends a non-trivial amount of revenue to me that also is somehow a great deal for the purchaser of this NFT. And I've yet to see something that actually makes that manifest.
Okay, so let's work through an example of an NFT game and talk about how they implement NFTs. Maybe that'll provide a little bit of clarity through an example. So let's take a game like Star Atlas, where pretty much, you know, it's a zero-sum situation, right? In order to participate, you need to buy an NFT, and that NFT can be taken, right? That's similar things to what we've seen in previous metaverses or virtual worlds. In that instance, for example, do you see NFTs successfully being implemented within this gaming context? And separately, from a point of interoperability, I think for economic incentives, the point you made there is a very serious one that should be reevaluated by a lot of projects. But specifically in that context, like Star Atlas, for example, what's your opinion on their implementation or plan to implement NFTs?
Right. Well, Star Atlas should ship their game first before we say too much about them, but we'll say some stuff anyway. Basically, the deal is that I think the really fundamental problem all NFT games have is the kind of customer they're attracting. They're very rarely attracting players, and they're mostly attracting people who are interested in airdrops and are really interested in the value of the assets they're purchasing. They're really interested in investing, essentially. It's like, I'm going to buy this thing and number's going to go up, right? So tell me how number go up. And whenever developers push back on this, they get a lot of resistance and disappointment in their Discord servers, because that bubble hype, everyone's kind of waiting for it to come back. And everyone's kind of like, oh, this is a winter. We've had winters before. It's going to come back. And I mean, I would just expect those contradictions to keep heightening. So with Star Atlas in specific, it's like, okay, let's just play it out anyway. Let's say they ship the game. Okay, so now you're paying $1,000 for a ship, and that ship can be taken. Maybe that ship can be destroyed, maybe it can't. I don't know what their exact mechanics are going to be. But let's play it out both ways. So, I mean, in a certain sense, people point to things like, you know, I could buy a Maserati and I could crash it, right? And then it would be lost to me. Or I could buy a gold watch, but someone could steal it, you know? But the thing is, in these games, basically the chances of crime or bad things happening to you are astronomically high compared to the real world. The chance of your virtual Maserati or virtual gold watch being stolen legally or illegally. By legally, I mean within the allowed rules of the game, and illegally through hacking. As we've seen when North Korea, you know, stole like, hundreds of millions from Axie Infinity. This is also something that has precedent. And the greatest precedent for this is the Wild West of the early days of Ultima Online, where they thought that they could have like this self-governing, super libertarian anarchist, you know, player base. And the players basically went and they strip mined the environment and they murdered and stole from each other and just acted all sorts of nasty. Now, some people like that and they play Eve and they go into Nullsec space, and that's exactly what they're there for. But I think there's a limit to how much people are going to be willing to put thousands of dollars of assets on the line in what's essentially a permadeath roguelike where you lose everything if you die. I think that will also encourage, to the degree you can extract real assets from the game, you will attract financially motivated players as step one, and then organized crime, frankly, as step two, which we, and then three, state level actors, step three, as we've seen with North Korea. North Korea has an entire department of people whose job was to basically steal money from crypto games, and they've done extremely well from themselves.
Okay, and so I'm just gonna ask a follow-up question just before we continue here. So let's use Star Alice as an example, but let's say instead of $1,000 for a ship, as you mentioned, let's say it's $10, right? How would that influence then that situation?
Well, so then you tampen down the risk greatly, right? Yeah. Because I mean, there's plenty of games right now that aren't blockchain based. It's like, yeah, I play $60 to enter. So I play $60 and then I go online and I get murdered a bunch and I find that the game's no fun and I quit. Yeah. Now I've lost $60, right? I think the amount of money is hugely important. I will point out that we have a class of blockchain games that are inarguably successful, that have succeeded on their own merits of being sustainable. And they are usually gambling games. And so I predict that gambling and gambling adjacent games will be the most successful games in the blockchain category moving forward. So by gambling games, I mean literal poker games, literal horse racing, literal stakes games, right? And then gambling adjacent, I think, are going to be things like extraction shooters and permadeath roguelikes that essentially encourage you to take big risks and put assets on the line and murder other players and take their stuff. And I think those are probably going to be some of your most popular categories, and they're going to appeal to that very gambling mindset of kind of a player. And that's just based off of the successful designs that I've seen. So yeah, that's kind of where I think things go, especially if real money assets are on the line, especially above and beyond the amount people would normally put into your traditional non-blockchain games.
Okay. I want to shift the conversation over to cryptocurrencies in games as opposed to strictly NFTs. If we saw, for example, in the next couple of years, a successful monetization strategy that incorporated an in-game token, for example, right? One that was not necessarily easy to sell once you had purchased it and it's now using within the game, would you see the potential of cryptocurrencies sticking around as these in-game currencies, and not specifically governance tokens, because we've seen a lot of issues of speculation around these tokens really doing the opposite of what they're intended to do, which is supposed to act as like an investment to the project, but is really just actually a speculative investment for most people. So in-game tokens as cryptocurrencies, something that might stick around?
Well, okay, let me try to like steel man that and see the best possible thing. Imagine if like Robux became like an actual fungible currency. And like right now it's like mostly only used. We've already seen all kinds of problems with Robux, where basically like Robux like essentially has value on the black market and all kinds of scams targeting teens, like luring them with free Robux to, you know, like take pictures of themselves and get exploited online and all kinds of things. So like there are a lot of games that have tried to do this before blockchain. You know, Steam used to be a lot more loosey-goosey with Steam Wallet, which has become increasingly locked down, because anytime real-world value can be generated through playing a game, basically you inevitably attract scammers and organized crime, and then state-level actors if the dollar numbers get high enough. And so it is a kind of a field that is littered with like cautionary tales if you go through the decades of online video game history that have tried to do this before. What blockchain adds is it doesn't really add anything new except for immutability, right? And immutability in some ways makes these problems worse, because now you can't reverse them with a call to customer service when your account gets wiped out. And so So I don't think if Robux was to become a cryptocurrency, that it would then like increase the adoption of cryptocurrency worldwide. I think what would happen instead is it would just cause congressional hearings about Roblox to happen faster. Now, I will flip it on the other way. If blockchain and cryptocurrencies can evolve to become a less worse PayPal, I think if the dog wags the tail rather than the tail wagging the dog, then you will for sure see increasing adoption in video games of cryptocurrencies. If cryptocurrencies basically evolve away from their current form and basically evolve into a less worse way to just send money point to point, then I think you'll see widespread adoption in games.
Yeah, I mean, I think that if I were to make an educated guess, that's the trajectory that cryptocurrencies are going to, right? Making it a lot easier to use for the mainstream public, and through the technological innovations that have been going on with infrastructure and layer two scaling solutions, it's quite incredible. You know, very, very bright people working to solve these problems. It's not exactly something that's not been being studied at all. So I would be interested, like you said, to see if cryptocurrencies will be more frequently incorporated into these games as cryptocurrencies in general become more relevant in societies or people who are not, you know, DeFi individuals.
Yeah, that'll depend on three things, I think. First, it's going to depend on getting volatility under control, because there's a bunch of people that accepted Bitcoin as payment, even Steam, I think, for a while. But just the volatility, that needs to get got under control. Second, you know, and this is one of the hardest one probably, is that a lot of people do not see immutability as a feature. They don't see trustless immutability, not your keys, not your crypto. They see that as a bug rather than a feature. So there needs to be some kind of solution to that. And then it needs to survive regulatory scrutiny, because no big company is going to touch anything with a 50-foot pole that that is going to invite congressional hearings on their butt. But if those three barriers can be surmounted by all the bright people who are working on this stuff, then I think we would see widespread adoption.
Yeah, it's interesting. I think we'll see. Maybe I'll have you on the podcast in a couple of years and we'll see if we were right or not. Yeah. Okay, Lars, just a couple more questions for you here today. So what would you say for individuals who are interested in learning more about how land value tax works? If someone is interested in learning more about these virtual worlds and wants to help build a virtual world through an economics perspective, a computer science background, finance background, what would you recommend for them?
So I have a website called gameofrent.com, which has all my writings about land economy on it. It's all free. And on that webpage are linked two articles under Georgism and game design. Georgism is the economic philosophy I espouse based on the works of Henry George. And the two articles I've written are called Land Speculators Will Kill Your Game's Growth and Land Value Tax in Online Games and Virtual Worlds, a How-To Guide, which is an actual policy paper I co-wrote with famous game designer Daniel Cook about how to actually implement these policies. And that's where I'm basically like quoting all my, you know, details about Vickrey auctions and stuff. So if you want to go there, you can read those. It's got a bunch of my other work about land economy in general. I later assembled all those articles into a book called, let's see if the blur filter will catch it. Let me turn that blur filter off.
And we'll link the book as well.
Right. Land is a big deal. So I wrote that book that collects my, it doesn't include too much about video games, but includes my more general things. But all of this stuff is free on gameofrent.com. And you can just read about game design and land speculation and how to avoid it and keep the worst things from happening to you and just learning from our very rich past of game design history.
Mm-hmm. So Lars, you've transitioned away from the game development space into your current work with land evaluations. I believe that's what it is. Would you recommend the path to become a game developer, or skip that and head straight to the land evaluations?
Well, so here's let me answer that in a general sense. If you want to make money as a programmer, go into make boring software. Make boring software for customers that pay, you know, multiple zeros a year on a subscription basis. Like basically, if you want to make money, don't make video games for a living. Sell SaaS software to dentists or the equivalent, right? I obviously am motivated by things other than money. That's why I went into game design in the first place. There's this old apocryphal story that I'm not sure is actually true about people trying to convert to Judaism, that like the rabbi, you know, is like, "Rabbi, make me a Jew." And the rabbi's like, "No, you're not ready." And like, got to turn him away three times. But if they come back the third time, it's like, "Okay, let's do it." I'm not Jewish. I'm not trying to make fun of Jews or anything. I think it's just a story I've heard, right? And so I feel the same way about video games. Like, if someone comes to me and is like, I want to make video games for a living, I'm like, no, you don't. Go away. You know, like, slap them in the face. Yeah. Kick them out. And if they come back the third time, then it's like, okay, you know what you're getting into, and you know what you're facing. It's just because, and I don't want to, like, say, like, a bunch of, like, slanderous horror stories about the industry. It's just true that whenever you're going into a creative field of any sort, there is an endless parade of 20-year-olds with more talent and less self-respect than you, you know, that are willing to work harder under worse conditions and who are frankly, like, better than you, you know, like, and it gets really disheartening over time. Like, and this affects you whether you are working for yourself or working for someone else. And what it means is that if you, with the same skills you have in game design, you can get a better job almost literally anywhere else in tech, because it's where the concentration of talent and the supply of talent is, like, the highest, because anyone will take your job for less pay and do, like, and work as hard as you and be fresh and not have, like, a wife and kids to feed and other things like that, you know? So I generally don't recommend for people to go into video games unless they have some really, really important reason they want to do it. And I also, I'm not trying to, like, say don't follow your dreams. What I am saying is that understand what you're getting into and don't do it because you want to keep a promise to your 8-year-old self. Like, because a lot of people, what they imagine video games is going to be is very different. When you make video games, you might not actually spend much time playing them afterwards. And it's a lot like movie critics kind of sometimes lose their love for movies because they're seeing movies over and over and over again. Mm-hmm. Making video games and enjoying that is entirely different from the enjoyment of playing them. And I very much enjoyed that. I very much got into it for that. And I don't regret my decision at all to do it. And it kind of laid the path to where I am today. I've just found at this stage of my life, now that I'm about to turn 40 and that I have 3 kids and, you know, other things going on in my life, and I've mostly accomplished what I want to in video games now, you know, especially when this next game of mine ships. I kind of have other things I want to do with my life that I haven't explored yet. And also, it's not a coincidence that I'll probably be able to make more money and, like, have healthcare and other things like that if I go do this other thing. So that's kind of where that transition came from. And that's kind of my general advice to people.
Great. Okay. Lars, I think that's a great note to end the podcast on. Thank you for joining me today. It was great to have you.
Yeah, thank you very much.
All right. Thanks, everyone, for tuning in. Keep an eye out for our next episode. Thank you.